This is 91.7 WVXU's Cincinnati Edition. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. The recent Ice Bucket Challenge has dramatically increased research funding and awareness of ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. But it's difficult for the general population to truly understand how devastating the disease is to ALS patients as well as their families and friends. It strikes about 5,000 Americans each year. 90% of the people with ALS die within 3 to 5 years, and there is no known cure for the disease. Joining us to look at what we do know about ALS and what life is like for someone who has the disease are neurologist with the University of Cincinnati Neuroscience Institute and director of the UC Health ALS Clinic, Dr. Robert Neal, and an ALS Association care coordinator and licensed social worker, Pinky Dressman. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100 or email us talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. And before we start today, I do want to mention my mother died of ALS in 2008 in Northern Ohio, and I attended some of the support groups that Pinky led in the Cincinnati area while my mother was suffering with the disease. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon.
Glad to have you both here.
Thank you.
Dr. Neal, let's start with you. And I think a lot of people really have heard of ALS and Lou Gehrig's disease, especially now. But I'm not sure everyone has a really good concept and understanding of what it is. What is, and say what it is, because I can't pronounce it, the long name.
So it's amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. And so the disease is actually a degenerative nerve disease. If you think about your nervous system, you have a central nervous system, which is your brain and spinal cord, and you have a peripheral nervous system, which is the nerves that carry information out to your arms and legs to do stuff. Also carries information to your mouth, to your breathing, all that stuff. And basically what you have is deterioration of the nerves, both in the central compartment and the peripheral compartment, and they die off. So what that affects is voluntary muscle. So being able to move your arms, being able to move your legs, being able to swallow, chew, talk, breathe. Those kind of things. There's different types of muscle. There's also smooth muscle and cardiac muscle. It does not affect those systems. So if you think about cardiac muscle, your heart is a huge muscle. Why doesn't ALS affect that? It's selective to the motor neurons that affect the voluntary motor system, not the heart or the smooth muscle in your gut.
Well, you mentioned breathing. What about lungs? Are lungs, I guess lungs aren't a muscle.
They aren't really a muscle at all. The interesting thing about the breathing is the fact that you have your diaphragm and your chest wall that really help you breathe. And so those are voluntary muscles. The diaphragm is voluntary. You can stop yourself breathing at any time and hold it in. Just think of a yogi who can actually hold their breath for a long time. Same thing. So you have control over those motor neurons to do that. Your brain does that control. But you slowly lose control of that. You lose the ability to control that. Those become weaker and begin dying off.
Talking about how it all first is noticed or first becomes aware of it, what do people notice? It can affect different people in different ways. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yes.
And so one of the things that we see most commonly is that people get, they pass around from doctor to doctor for a while. And they're trying to figure out, why did this happen? What's going on? Oftentimes we see them, they start with an orthopedic doctor. And it's because they're having weakness in an arm or weakness in a leg or a problem. And they're thinking, oh, I'm getting old. I have rotator cuff. That's what it is. And oftentimes they get passed around so much and no one really is sure exactly what they're dealing with yet until someone takes a little time and says, wait a minute. This is more than just a muscle problem. This is more than a bone problem. There's actually something breaking down here. And that's when we finally get to see them. And they say, you need to see a neurologist.
And that would be limb onset. But the bulbar onset, the person may sound like they've been out drinking. Or the first people say to them, have you been drinking? Or because their voice tends to slur. Or they find themselves clearing their throat after eating. Or they are having a little bit of shortness of breath, which is actually would be a respiratory onset, which is more rare than any of the other two. But bulbar affects a great deal of ALS patients too, besides limb onset.
And what's interesting about that, that what Pinky brings up the bulbar ALS, is those patients also have upper motor neuron. So imagine you have two different systems. You have the central compartment and the peripheral compartment. In the central compartment, when you have problems there, you get spasticity and problems like that.
What does that mean?
So spasticity is basically you lose the inhibition over the motor neurons that you normally would have. So a patient might sound like this and have trouble. So we always say the speed And the strangled quality of the voice is another way that a bulbar ALS patient can present. Not that breathy, kind of can't talk. Mm-hmm. So there are different ways that actually someone could present. I have not seen two patients that have presented exactly the same. And while they might present here, like Pinky was saying, in the mouth, or they might present in the lungs, mm-hmm. they might present in one arm, they might present in both arms, they might present in one leg, they might present in one side. So it can be very, very different. I think the thing that's the hallmark for us is really painless. It's a painless process. It's painless weakness. There shouldn't be sensory symptoms. There shouldn't be a lot of pain.
At least early on. Pain will enter into the equation later on.
And that's mainly just because you lose muscle. And one of the jobs of muscle is to keep joints off of each other. So if you think about it that way, pain is a later effect, but it's not the disease itself.
One of the things that you brought up, and certainly that I experienced with my own mom, is the idea that you don't know what's wrong for such a long time. And that can go on. I think in her case, it was a year mm-hmm. before we had any idea what was causing. I mean, she went through physical therapy and she was having trouble walking, and she went and her job was a receptionist. And they said, you talk so slowly on the phone now. Why are you talking so slowly on the phone? And nobody really knew. What do you advise people? Because it could happen, and somebody might need to see an orthopedic surgeon or orthopedic doctor and really have some other problems. How do you start to begin to ask the question, might this be ALS?
It's a good question. I think it's a matter of luck, actually. Do you get to a physician who has the ability to recognize those symptoms early on? Sometimes you don't get to that type of physician, and it's always a sad day for me when I get a referral of an ALS patient from hospice. We want to get them in the early diagnosis so we can get them all the help. But I think sometimes this disease mimics so many other illnesses that it's very hard for a doctor who has had very little experience with ALS to recognize the symptoms and get them onto the right person. It's more recognizing the early symptoms and knowing that it could possibly be ALS and more of a neurological disease than a bone or, just simply muscle disease.
And I think what I would say is part of the failure is our system. We don't necessarily have a good education system for ALS. A lot of the advances of ALS, and classically in neurology, we're told, you can diagnose everything you want, but you can't fix anything. And that has changed so much in the last 20 years for us, 30 years. Just look at stroke treatment. So for us, it's educating people again to recognize the signs early. And that means doctors educating doctors and future medical students, nursing staff, social workers, all sorts of people so that everyone knows about it. So again, talking about it, educating, learning, that's what helps. I also would say that patients coming forward and telling their stories and letting people know.
Yes.
One of the things we see is that there can be mobility issues, so you can't get out of the house. And so people become shadows of who they used to be. And we lose the exposure that a lot of other people can have to say, look, this is what's happening to me, recognize it. And I think that's a...
I agree. Telling their story is very important. It's also very therapeutic for them to be able to tell their story.
One of the interesting parts of this to me was that there's really no test you can do to say, oh yeah, this is ALS. You test basically, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is just from my own experience with my mom, but you test for everything else. And I think the final thing they ruled out for her was multiple sclerosis. And when she didn't have that, then they said, you have ALS.
So I would say you look for everything else that this could be. MS is a very specific disease. So MS, again, oftentimes doesn't, it can be in the differential in the upper motor neuron, that central compartment form of ALS. But ALS is a combination of the two. And MS is a pure central nervous system or that central compartment disease. So you're looking for that combination of the two diseases. You're looking for signs on the exam. You're looking for signs and symptoms. And then you're also looking for electrophysiology. So any ALS patient will tell you one of the worst things is going through the EMG, which is a diagnostic test. It's not comfortable. But we do it all the time, and we have to do it. It's how we actually look at nerve and muscle.
Let's talk about what that is, because I will say they would not let me. They let me in the room with my mom for every test she took except that one. They said, you can't stay for this. It will be too uncomfortable for you to watch. And she
was miserable when she came out from that one every time. She had to have it twice. So explain what you're trying to do when you do an EMG. What is that?
So an EMG is a test where I actually take a small needle. The needle is actually has two electrodes in it. Imagine it like you're doing an EKG. So you're looking at electrical waves from the heart. This, I'm looking at electrical waves of the muscle cells themselves. And I can read how the muscle cells are reacting to other muscle cells and to the nerves that are coming from your spinal cord. So that's why it's unfortunately a very direct test where you're putting needles in different muscles of someone's body. That's the painful part. If it's done well and you talk to your patient while you're doing the test, it's uncomfortable, but it will pass. And
what do you find out from it?
You can see signs of active nerve damage and chronic nerve damage, and you need both of those to be able to make the diagnosis. You can see nerve damage from, let's say, you pinched a nerve in your back a long time ago. I can see that. 5 years down the road, I can see that. But unless there's active, ongoing nerve damage, I won't see that. So I need to see both of those things, ongoing and chronic damage.
And I think that's part of the problem of the diagnosis, because we have some I get calls from patients that say, I'm a probable. They can't absolutely say I'm ALS at this time, and that can go on for a while depending on their prognosis. It also impedes their ability to accept their diagnosis at times because there isn't a definitive 100%. I mean, I think in working all these years with Dr. Neal, when he tells me it's ALS, I believe it's ALS. But that's when you're a person who actually gets that diagnosis and there's no 100% definitive, it kind of leaves you hanging until the symptoms catch up to a level that you know it can't be anything else. And unfortunately, that could be make you fairly advanced, middle to end stages sometimes.
We're talking today about ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease, and we're going to continue our discussion in just a moment. You can call us at 513-419-7100 or email us talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. We're talking this afternoon about ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease. My guest today, neurologist with the University of Cincinnati Neuroscience Institute and director of the UC Health ALS Clinic, Dr. Robert Neal, and an ALS Association care coordinator, Pinky Dressman. She's also a licensed social worker. You can call us at 513-419-7100 or email us talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. I do want you to know my mother died of ALS in 2008 in Northern Ohio, and I attended some of the support groups that Pinky led in the Cincinnati area while my mother was suffering from the disease. We've talked a lot about diagnosis and just what the disease is and explaining it. Once a person is diagnosed, what do you do?
Well, that's one of the things, because we can't cure the disease, we work on trying to make life better. And I would say that I've really worked on quality of life issues and trying to do a comprehensive care for a patient that involves looking at things like breathing, swallowing, talking, communication, mobility, the home environment, support networks. And we also have to, one of the things that doctors aren't good about necessarily is talking about mood and cognitive dysfunction. And there can be a lot of mood, a lot of depression, those kind of things. So I work with the tools that I have, which are usually medications and therapists and a team of professionals that actually help us help patients better.
And in my case, I like I said earlier, I'd like to get them very early on because they might be still working. We have to help them get Social Security, get their Medicare benefits. If they're a veteran, we want to hook them up with the VA. We want to help, you know, get them involved with an elder med attorney to help get some of their affairs in order. And then we want to assess right away for equipment needs, depending on if they're struggling, if they need a manual wheelchair, or if they need a quad cane or a ramp for their house. Our association can provide these free of charge through our loaner program. And we have a monthly newsletter with lots of information. And when we get a patient that's diagnosed, immediately we send out a packet that is complete with 6 books on how to live with ALS, a complete resource guide, and lots of other helpful information, including the National ALS Directory, National Registry, that we want to get our patients registered so they can. It's the largest research project going on in the United States right now, and it's really critical that our patients are signing up for that. So we basically want to look at their whole life, how they're coping, and help them in every area that we can.
And on top of that, there is one medication that is FDA approved right now to slow down the disease process. It's called Ruyatec or Ruyazol. It's FDA approved. It can be very expensive if you don't have insurance. It can slow down the disease process by up to 2 months. We usually say maybe 2 to 3 months. So it's not like you're telling someone I'm going to stop this or I'm going to fix it, but I can slow this down. So patients get to make a decision about whether or not they want to take that medication.
And basically, they would just live for an additional 2 months if they take it, probably.
Correct. And one of the sad things about all the studies for that drug were that they actually just looked at quantity of life. They never really looked at quality of life. And that, I think, figures in so much into the discussion that you actually have to talk about that. And patients make their own decision based on that.
The number to call if you have a question is 513-419-7100. Gabrielle is calling from Cincinnati. Hi, Gabrielle. What's your question?
Hi. I was just curious. I have heard that ALS is pretty much concentrated in the developed world, incidence of the occurrence of it. And I'm just curious if either of you have an opinion as to why that's the case, why it's more common in the developed world.
I wonder if it's developed, if it's just the fact that maybe we're trained to recognize it and we see more of it, and that actually you have a lot of people in the underdeveloped world that actually are dying from this disease that don't know that that's what they're dying from. Even in our own country, we've seen an increase in the incidence and prevalence of this disease because we are being trained to recognize it better. And I think that's very common with a lot of diseases. Pink?
I think we see that, especially in our cases of 10% that are familial. And when they lost their great-grandparent to this, they didn't know it was ALS. It wasn't recognized, and now it is. So I think that has a lot to do with it.
Thanks so much for your call, Gabrielle. We appreciate it. Again, our number is 513-419-7100. Carol's calling from Delhi. Hi, Carol. What's your question?
Yes. My mother died in 1996, and she was down at UC. But she was diagnosed with primary lateral sclerosis. Mm-hmm. What is the difference between the two?
So primary lateral sclerosis is kind of a sister disease to ALS. Remember how we were talking a little bit before that there's the central compartment, which is your brain and spinal cord, and then there's the peripheral compartment, which is peripheral nerve and muscle. It's the one that actually affects the central system predominantly. And so you don't get the muscle wasting. You're dealing more with spasticity problems and all the problems of spasticity. I didn't explain spasticity better beforehand, but if you think about someone who has cerebral palsy or someone who's had a stroke, a lot of times you'll see the deficits of spasticity, which are tightness, inability to relax a lot of times. And it almost, again, when you hear them talk, it sounds like they are straining to speak. But it really is just, it's the upper motor neuron form. There's a lower motor neuron form called progressive or primary muscular atrophy. And that is the other one, the other side, where it's only in the peripheral compartment. The people with PLS, oftentimes I find it's a little
less aggressive.
It's a lot less aggressive, actually. And I've had a little, it's been a little bit easier to take care of them and to help them.
Yeah. And actually, we actually take care of both ALS and PLS because they're so closely related and the symptoms are the same and we can help them with our equipment the same way.
Carol, thanks so much for your call. We appreciate it. Our number, 513-419-7100, if you have a question today about ALS. Ken is calling from Cincinnati. Hi, Ken.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good.
Just really wanted to call with a comment for the great work that Pinky does. My name is Ken Moore. I've done some ALS care here locally for some of the patients, and I think Pinky has actually secured me for a couple of those, and I'm just glad to hear that it's getting the exposure that it needs, just because the care is different in regard to the nature of the fact that the body is giving out around a very functional brain, which allows it to be a kind of a different care situation when you're dealing with the families and the situations. And just wanted to applaud Pinky for the excellent job she does. And
thank you, Ken.
Great work that Neil does, Dr. Neil does in regard to this. I've had the ability to work with him and get the equipment and the things needed for the patients, and just wanted to say she does a great job.
Yes, she does.
Yeah.
Yes,
thanks.
She does.
Ken, thank you so much. We appreciate the call.
One of the things that I heard him talk about was actually the cognitive part. And one of the things that we've definitely recognized is that there is, in probably about 30% of the patients, there is cognitive. And it actually overlaps with a disease called frontotemporal dementia. And so this is one of the reasons also where I look for why a patient might have been missed for a while, is that they're not aware of what's happening to themselves. It's almost like a benevolent blissfulness that they don't know what's happening to them.
But it's very different from like an Alzheimer's type dementia, completely different. They can mask it beautifully. If you run into them in the middle of the street, you talk to them, never know they had this type of dementia. It's very different, and they have a hard time multitasking and following steps, and they might fixate on one idea, and they tend to not be as acceptive of measures that would be helpful for them, like the BiPAP or the feeding tube or things like that.
It's usually because they lose the ability to actually, for example, with the BiPAP, which is a respiratory aid, they forget that they need to keep it on, or they don't see why they keep having to put this back on at nighttime.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the BiPAP, and I'm a little bit familiar with it. My mom did use one of those. It's not a ventilator or anything like that. But what does it do to help the patient become more comfortable, especially when sleeping?
Well, the biggest thing is it gets rid of the CO2 that builds up in the patient's body, which is so dangerous and so critical that it gets removed because it's poisonous for them and makes them very fatigued. So it has a huge influence on their quality of life, and I'll let you talk about the specifics.
So basically your lungs function to exchange oxygen and to exchange carbon dioxide. You need to bring oxygen in, you need to get carbon dioxide out. Carbon dioxide is our waste product. It's bad. We use it. It's a common waste product for everything in our body. And basically what this does is the BiPAP pushes air in and keeps the airways open so that you can actually exchange oxygen and carbon dioxide. Our brains are kind of interesting in that they don't sense when carbon dioxide builds up very well. We have a good response when oxygen is low, and it says, hey, you need to do something about this. You start to feel short of breath. When carbon dioxide builds up, you just get sleepy, and you can get a headache. But it's not the same kind of panic that you get when oxygen goes low. But the BiPAP is basically a mask that goes over your face or over your nose. It can go just over your mouth, just over your nose. It can actually be just pillows under your nose, and it blows that air in so that you can effectively get rid of that poison.
And this is different than what the people use that have sleep apnea, correct?
It is different. It's a bilateral pressure, not a continuous pressure.
But you can have people, so there's CPAP, BiPAP, and then there's even now AVAP, and there are new functional types of these breathing devices. CPAP is what's recommended for people with just sleep apnea, and the bilevel PAP is, it's a little bit softer. It ramps up, actually, so it has two different pressures to it.
It pulls the air out, too, which pulls the CO2 out, which the continuous pressure does.
And that, of course, is just one of the pieces of equipment that people might need. We're going to talk about more of those in just a moment. But first, we're going to go to the phones. Again, our number, 513-419-7100, if you'd like to talk about ALS today. Eugene is calling from Mason. Hi, Eugene.
Hello.
What's your question?
I just wanted to know, what is the age range primarily when this occurs, ALS?
Unfortunately, it's probably, we would say, in the middle years, from 40 to 60. It has a predilection for males more than females, and probably white males more than African-American males in our country. But I will tell you, I've seen the age range from 20 to 94.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we've had patients that have been very elderly, dealing with this at the very end of their life.
It doesn't really discriminate between. Nope. I mean, there are more males, but then again, there's a strong relation between the military. And at that time, we had a lot more men in the military than women, so that might be a factor of that. Secondly, it doesn't affect socioeconomic. It can be any, it doesn't race. It doesn't discriminate. So it's a very non-discriminating disease.
Does that answer your question, Eugene?
Yes, I was wondering, is there any occupational studies that have been done to identify certain occupations?